gone insane. An upside-down civilization cannot be real. A world of madness and terror.
It's the Dana Gould Hour.
Hey, everybody. Dana Gould here. How you doing? Don't panic. This is not the Halloween episode, but the Halloween episode is coming. So this is what went on. In August, because of a car accident I was in, the whole schedule for the podcast got sort of thrown up in the air for a lot of things. And now I'm getting back on schedule. Didn't really have time to put out an effective September episode. What came out in early September was the August episode, which was delayed because of, see, accident, comma, car. Anyway, so there are two interviews that I wanted to do for September, and what I thought I would do is we're going to split them up. So this episode is with Patty Schemmel, who's a brilliant musician. She was the drummer for the band Hole. She had a first-person account of the Seattle scene in the late 80s, early 90s, and she's written a brilliant book called Hit So Hard, which also has a documentary that was made. So Patty is this interview, and this is what I did. Just to get it out, it's just the interview. Me and Patty talking almost as if I had a regular podcast. So I hope you enjoy it. The other interview is with Edward Pepitone. That's on our Patreon page. So if you're a Patreon member, go on over there and listen to an interview with Eddie Pepitone. The Halloween episode will be out around October 20th, and that's going to be a whopper. It stars Dolomite Is My Name screenwriters Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski. They also wrote Ed Wood, People vs. Larry Flint, People vs. O.J. Simpson, Man on the Moon. So many amazing, amazing movies. And they're great guys, hilarious storytellers, and super good friends of mine. I'm so happy to. And Dolomite Is My Name. Go see it. Stars Eddie Murphy. It's the biopic of Rudy Ray Moore. Dolomite, it's fantastic. I can't say enough good about it. And you'll hear all about that on the Halloween episode. Also, Jeffrey Combs. He starred in a little movie called Reanimator, and many, many others. Anybody who's a fan of the genre knows Jeffrey Combs. And also, Mike Mendez and Matt Weinhold are going to give us a year-end recap of horror films. Mike Mendez, a very talented writer and director, made Don't Kill It, Big Ass Spider. Matt Weinhold is the co-host of the excellent podcast Monster Party. So that's all coming up for Halloween later this month, but for now, this should make up for the lost time in August. If you're a Patreon member, go on over there and hear me and Eddie Pepitone. If you're not a Patreon member, why don't you become one? Go on down to danagould.com and sign up. It's pretty good. Before we get going, here are some shows that you should know about. If you are in the New York area on October 11th, we are doing Plan 9 from Outer Space live at the Tarrytown Music Hall as part of the Sleepy Hollow Film Festival. It stars Scott Adsit, Jeffrey Combs, Frank Conniff, Bobcat Goldthwait, me, Jean Grey, Paul Greenberg, John Hodgman, Jonah Ray, Jackie Harris Greenberg, G. Charles Wright, and Kat Agason as Vampyra. Then, on October 29th, Plan 9 from Outer Space in Los Angeles, only at Largo. And that also has an all-star cast. Me, again, Bobcat Goldthwait, Janet Varney, Matt Bronger, Tom Kenny, Jonah Ray, Lorraine Newman, Paul F. Tompkins, Steven Weber, G. Charles Wright, and once again, Katherine Augustin as Vampyra. That's October 29th at Largo. And then in November, from the 7th to 9th, I will be in St. Louis, Missouri at the Helium Comedy Club. November 14th, 15th, and 16th, I will be in Boston at the Boston Comedy Festival. And November 21st, 2nd, and 3rd, I will be in Minneapolis, Minnesota at Acme Comedy Company. Three great gigs. And then in December, back to San Francisco. But that's enough for now. All right, everybody. That's good. Here's the show. Listen up and then go over to Patreon and, yeah, all that stuff.
Gould Hour. Free and worth it.
It is a lovely sun-dappled day. We're getting into fall. Temperatures dipping down into the mid-90s. Crows bursting into flames as they fly across the sky. And we are here at Falcon's Lair Recording Studios, high atop the Mulholland Drive view shelf here in sunny Southern California, where the powers that be and their friends hang out. On a guest today's podcast came to us by way of friend of the podcast, Rob Zabrecki. She has an amazing book and documentary. The book is called Hit So Hard. It is a brutally honest and freakishly easy to read book that I want to actually talk to her about. Many know the author. Certainly, if you're a listener of this podcast, and we all tend to share the common interest, as the drummer for the band Hole. But her story of that and survival coming out of the 90s and the early aughts in one piece is pretty amazing. Please welcome Patty Schemmel.
Hi. Thanks
How
for
are
having
you?
Me. I'm good. I'm good.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it is a beautiful day.
Now, how do you know Zabrecki? Just from
Early music, from playing shows when he was in his band Possum Dixon, but also through his magic, going to see his show.
Uh-huh.
And then he asked me to be on his show that he was doing, the seance show that I think he
did.
You. And so I did a little guest spot on that. And
hilarious.
Yes.
Like many former musicians, he is now a magician.
A good one.
I know. He's amazing. He's jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
But you're still a musician.
Yes, I'm a musician.
And a mom.
And I also teach woodworking to kids, a lot of different things.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What's interesting is you grew up in Washington State.
Yeah.
And you were at the perfect age to be in the grunge scene in the 90s. You knew Cobain from that scene. You knew Cobain before you knew Courtney Love. You met.
Yeah.
But what I find interesting is, you know, that was a very druggy scene.
Mm-hmm.
And you grew up in a world of sobriety.
Yeah. Both my parents were in recovery and they came out to the Northwest from Brooklyn, New York, where they met each other in a AA meeting. And so,
and you had AA meetings like in your house as a kid.
Yeah. And it like old school. So, you know, and there was always, you know, coffee and
that old coffee urn.
Yeah. And cigarettes.
Yeah.
And my parents would have, there was a thing called the 12 step where, you know, they'd go out and help a person in need, you know, that
sure.
bring them over. And so there's always that going on in, uh-huh. In the living room.
And those people are always great.
Fun. Yes. So I grew up in kind of the 12 steps in recovery were sort of our guideline for living in our house. And, so of course I got dealt with the double whammy of having two parents and that are alcoholics. So I guess, you know, then of course I've got the gene.
Sure.
Know, it's in my DNA.
I know that gene.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had my first drink at 12.
Was it a rebellious thing because your parent, like,
not at all,
just a normal 12 year old.
My parents got divorced when I was 11. And then all of a sudden that was sort of they weren't home. You know, and so there, my brother and I had this, you know, had the television and that was it. And, you know,
and you're in Olympia or?
No, in Marysville.
Marysville,
which is between Seattle and Vancouver, BC.
Is there an element of the fact that you don't see the sun a lot?
I believe so. Yeah.
I mean, no, because my friend, I have a really good friend named Drake Sather, who is from Seattle and he's a comedian and a writer and brilliant and sadly took his life years ago. And he had serious depression issues all of his life. And he would say that I grew up in a basement drinking coffee because it was raining all the time.
Right. Yeah. And, like, and that's like, I think
that. So if you live in a Cure song.
Our music, you know, the Seattle sound was it. We all were in bands because every house had a basement.
Right.
And it was always raining, and we would drink beer and play music in someone's basement.
Right. You
know, rent was cheap. And that's how the Seattle scene came around. No one ever thought that it would be something people would notice it or think it's cool or anything. We were just doing our thing.
Yeah, well, it was like any artistic scene. Yeah. It arrived out of a combination of environmental elements,
right,
economic elements, and a social scene. All my friends are into the same thing. We all kind of dress the same because kids of the same age dress the same.
All the parents worked at the mill, so there's like everybody had a flannel,
right,
from the lumberjacks.
Yeah, and it's also because it's cold.
Yes, so yeah.
And it must have been so strange to you to see now they're selling. I just remember like when the grunge look went to Urban Outfitters,
mm-hmm,
and it's like high-end flannel shirts.
I know, and still to this day, laughable. I have a moment. At least every couple months where I'm out in the world, you know, shopping or something, and I come across something like, you know, a Nirvana t-shirt at the Target, and I have that moment where I'm like, whew, whoa, you know, yeah, and I kind of look up at the ceiling and go, wow, you know, think about what does Kurt think of that, you know, like,
and people wearing Nirvana shirts that don't know,
right,
them wouldn't know if it's on the radio.
And it's like it's become sort of like classic rock, like you see a Hendrix shirt.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always felt when Straight Outta Compton came out, mm-hmm, the movie, and then you see like Straight Out of Yoga Class, and how people who live in South Central must feel, this, you know, like women in Brentwood, you're like, you know, straight out of hot yoga.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
It's the great American co-op. It's a long and proud tradition. So you had your first drink at 12.
Yeah.
By what age would you say you were an alcoholic?
Right, that from
get go.
I mean, I drank, and then all of a sudden it was like you hear so many alcoholics say that finally, then there was that sort of ease and that comfort, like a blanket. You know, like okay,
uh-huh,
this is now I can
function,
begin and function. Yeah,
yeah. And there's that other thing that it's interesting, and your development gets pinned at that, uh-huh, age.
Yeah. So you don't learn how to, you know, instead of dealing with dysfunction in relationships and family, you just drink and then you never really grow emotionally. Or
the book hit so hard. One of the theses of the book,
uh-huh,
is that being in a band fuels addiction, that the social structure of a band, your lifestyle, availability of money, it's a perfect storm.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to make you.
Yeah. When I got into
you have to have brutally strict rules of self-control.
Right.
And to not slide down that rabbit hole.
I came up playing in bands. And then when I got into Hole, it was, okay, here's a band. I'm going to be able to pay my bills with music. And so it was like I'd struck gold because I didn't have to work. And I thought, oh, this is how it is. You get to drink all day and, you know,
right,
not really.
Yeah.
As I explain in the book, you got to show up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and especially if you're the drummer, I mean, you get a little more leeway if you're the singer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Not
yeah.
So much.
Yeah. You've really got to. Yeah. You can just breeze in and breeze out.
Yeah. Because that's part of your deal. It's like,
sure,
well, so-and-so didn't show up.
Where I grew up, when I grew up, everyone, it was mandatory. And I know two kids that didn't do this and they were both fined. You had to read No One Here Gets Out Alive at the age of 13.
Which I did, but I'm a little older, but yes.
Yeah. And you had to read it. And the stories of John Densmore, who literally, No One Here Gets Out Alive is the book Danny Sugarman wrote about the Doors. And Danny Sugarman literally getting hives from dealing with Jim Morrison, who was the singer and could just breeze in and blow. And it is also like, you read it when you're older and you go like, oh, this guy was just a really nice guy who was a sad alcoholic, who when he was drunk was an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you're just drunk more than you're sober, and you're an asshole more than you're a nice guy. Right. And it's just that simple.
Yeah. And it's being an alcoholic, you have that weird ego where you think, you know, you're better than, but you're not. So you drink.
Yeah.
People are really blowing smoke a lot, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm sure.
Someone described it as, and I wish this was mine.
Yeah.
You're the piece of shit the sun revolves around.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Twenty-seven seems to be the age.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about that age.
Yeah, we do a segment in my doc about that, the 27. The
yeah.
Year.
I don't know what it is, but that's when everybody checks out.
Yeah.
That is just full bore.
There's some sort of connection with your Saturn return.
I know. My 27th yeah. year, I have never had addiction problems, but I have all the pathology. I grew up with it. I literally just didn't do everything
right out
of rebellion. Because I had four older brothers and two parents, and everybody was drinking all the time, and a younger sister. And so I literally was just like the Marilyn Munster. I just did everything differently, but still have the pathology. And when I started taking, when I was 27, I just cracked up. I just started having panic attacks all the time and couldn't sleep and couldn't function. And I went on antidepressant. I went on Zoloft, anti-anxiety. And the doctor said, who's still my doctor? And he said, you know, you can medicate with a sledgehammer or you can medicate with a scalpel. That's really what it is. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you can just obliterate yourself or you can do it a little more specifically.
What was the thing growing up that connected you that you were like, it's not drugs and alcohol, but it was like a thing that you said, oh, okay, this is my thing. This is how I feel good.
Oh, I was and am I was really into monster movies and Star Trek and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I got into comedy. I wanted to be a comedian at around the age of 13 and 14, and I started at 17. So I really just bulldozed myself in that. And I gravitated to that. I was an usher at the movie theater.
Yeah.
I gouged survival mechanisms out of the face of my upbringing, which is what you do.
Yeah.
You know?
For me, it was the same with music, but also my brother and I dove into monster movies and would, you know, where we lived, we could get a subscription to Fangoria, you know,
yeah, sure.
And then, you know, we would get when VCRs came out, that was like our salvation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was our thing. It was monster movies and Planet of the Apes was it. And that was all we did was...
Do you know my...
Yes, I do.
Okay.
So it was all we did was do our ape collectibles.
Oh, my God.
And then... You know,
before you leave, I'll blow your mind with a couple
of... And then also, we were really into Kiss, the band.
Yeah, as well you should be.
And then, so instead of...
That's the genius of Kiss, is they were a rock band and they were monsters.
I know. And like everybody, like people would look at, you know, in the 90s, all my friends that weren't into Kiss would be like, why were you ever... It's like a thing you get into when you're a kid. It never leaves you.
No.
Never.
No.
You know, like, I know girls that were so into the Spice Girls, and I'm like, what? But it's a thing.
It will
never go away.
It's comfort food. It's what makes you feel good.
And that's
you feel happy.
What we did was collect and have ape talk with friends. There was only very few people that were into apes.
Holy Lord.
I'm not kidding. And so we would have ape talk with friends that collected too, but they were like maybe two kids I knew. And then there was that one that wanted to be, but not really.
Just didn't have it.
Like just into the TV show and
sure.
Not really all the way.
How dare they?
Yeah, no.
This conversation is over.
Yeah.
You know, for the kids now, our kids, it's their phone. You know, somebody said a really interesting thing about music that Eddie Gorodetsky, I don't know if you know Eddie Gorodetsky, he's really brilliant. He's a comedy writer, television writer, but he's a musicologist. He produced Bob Dylan's Theme Time Radio Hour. He's works with Elvis Costello a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He said that like kids don't place their dreams in music as much now as they do in gaming. That you can slide into the world of gaming more than we used to just put on our headphones.
Yeah.
They go into video games, which is an interesting...
And that's their magical world.
Yeah, yeah. And it's your way to be not here. I know my oldest daughter isn't into music at all, but is really into Fortnite and all of these. When you were, so you started drinking on 12, and then how quickly did that go into drugs?
Let's see. Yeah, pretty quickly. Once I, you know, had my first drink, then it's that chase to get to have that feeling and to maintain it. So, which meant a lot of different chemistry, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's marijuana, just you're.
Right.
And when I got into punk rock, I would go into the city and play in bands and stuff. And there were, then cocaine shows up because, you know, you want to drink, but you also need to play drums. Right. So, yeah, so it was just.
And drums were always your instrument.
Yeah, always.
And did that, was it because there was a natural level of aggression that you just needed
exactly.
to.
Yeah, that was my release, was to sit at drums. And I was kind of. Understandable. Had a lot of energy and pent up and. So when I
and anybody who's heard the Buddy Rich tapes knows that drummers are by and large very serene.
Yeah. Clams. Yeah.
Clams. Everybody get at your clams.
Yeah.
How dare you play like that for me?
God. I saw Buddy Rich. He came to like our local community college when I was a kid. My mom took me. And I remember he was smoking in the gymnasium playing.
With his toupee.
And he was an asshole.
Oh no, well, he's a monster. You said that one of the reasons that you got into drugs is that it helped you deal with your sexuality, but not repress it. I know firsthand, unrelated to all of the horrors of the Catholic Church, a lot of Catholic guys who are gay and grow up heavily religious think that there's something wrong with them. And that the only way they can deal with this is to give their lives to God in hopes that he will expunge or forgive them for it. And it is a self-imposed prison sentence. And then you go into this ludicrous culture where you're not supposed to have sex at all, which is the foundation of that is a real estate scam.
Uh-huh.
And it's so, so maddening. But in your case, you said that being inebriated helped facilitate your acceptance of your sexuality.
Yeah.
It wasn't to repress it or deny it or run away from it.
Yeah, it was. I just felt better about myself generally when I was on drugs. And there was a moment which I talk about in my book where I was at such a horrible point in my life. And I remember I made a pass at a girl while I was drunk at a party.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, shocking moment. She's disgusted, you know, and I came out of that and I would use alcohol as an excuse. Well, I was drunk.
Sorry, I was drunk,
That was the impetus to me telling my mom that I was gay.
Right.
And so, and then feeling okay about it moving on.
And their reaction was?
Really supportive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I often wonder, my ex-wife is engaged to her partner, who's a woman. And do you change later that, or is it always there? Is it... I guess it's different for everyone, but to grow up in a culture where such an integral part of your being gives you a sense of shame or wrong, it's mind boggling when you step back and look at it, you know, and the fact that it's still going on now in the 21st century
I think about that and just sort of pushing that out of my, you know, growing up and being like a teenager and like with all the stuff that goes on with that and identity and then trying to squish down that part of myself. Getting into punk rock and the people that like punk rock helped me a lot to like, everybody was a freak and it was okay to be a freak.
Yeah. That
helped.
That was a great thing about Cobain specifically,
who
it was such a big star, was that his heart was so in the right place. Because, you know, I just interviewed a lot of people from the book about the 80s scene in L.A.
Uh-huh. I know.
More Fun in the New World.
Yeah, I read it. It's great.
And they're talking about how the initial burst of the punk scene was everybody's welcome, we're all freaks. I call it Pee-wee's Playhouse. We're all welcome in Pee-wee's Playhouse, which is what you want the world to be. And then suddenly it became really male and aggro, like the OC kids came up.
Hardcore.
And it became really fascist ideology and, you know, fetishizing all that juvenile horseshit. So the fact that Kurt Cobain, it bothered him that his became so popular that those people were fans of his.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that must have dealt with you as well. You guys must have had that as well.
Yeah. Not so much in my band, but I mean, we...
Well, you were not an all-girl band.
Yeah. But it not so much. There wasn't a lot of that jock dude, you know, into Hole. But I know that...
You can't pick your fans.
Yeah. Our fans are pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. But I know it must have... I mean, I don't know him, but I read enough that, like, it really bothered him that those jerks liked his music.
Yeah, that Nirvana became so, you know, mainstream the football team was listening to.
And that he would wear a dress just like to...
Yeah. He took advantage of that.
Yeah, to bum people out. And now it's, you know, you see that we're in a new culture where there's nothing unusual about being...
Yeah,
about being gay now.
Yeah. Or, you know, being a different... I think music is... Everybody's seen everything, it seems. You can't be shocked. Like when I watched David Bowie get carried out on Saturday Night Live and do... With Klaus Nomi.
I remember,
freaked my mind out. And I was like, this is the greatest. Does that moment still happen?
I don't know. I have a funny story about that actual thing. I remember watching... Yeah, I think I've actually told this story on this podcast before. I remember watching the original SNL. Bowie was singing Boys Keep Swinging. Mm-hmm. And he was in a Women's Army Corps outfit. He had a skirt on. Mm-hmm. And my dad came home. My dad would come home. He was a bartender. And he would come home. Always get home in the middle of the second musical number of SNL.
Uh-huh.
And I happened to be watching it alone, and he came in and looked at the TV and looked at me and leaned down right in my face, drunk, and just went, "You like that queer, Dana?"
You know? Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Like, wow. No, hell no. I was just making sure I recognize him in case I need to beat him up. But in fact, I remember when Prop 8 was here in LA, in California, talking to my daughter, who goes to a very progressive school, and she was like, "What is it about?" And I remember going like, "Well, some people don't like the idea that there are two mommies and two daddies."
Mm-hmm.
And she was just like, "Why?" And that it was great and that I had to explain it.
Yeah.
But I remember a commercial for Prop 8, a girl comes home from school and she goes, "Mommy, today in school, they said that I could marry anybody I want." And I was thinking like, "Oh, good, this is..." And then the mother goes, "What?" Uh-huh. And it was like, "Why would you want your child to think they could marry anybody they want?"
Yeah.
Yeah. Weren't we on the moon 40 years ago?
Yeah.
How do we go back?
Though, you know, still today, there's those moments. I mean, especially it seems it's like things have folded backwards.
Yeah, they are.
Inside itself.
And, yeah. Well, progress is, it retracts and expands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're in a cultural retraction now, and it will expand at some point, hopefully before it's too late. There's a lot of economic elements that involved, you know, it boils down to, you used to be able to make a really good living in this country swinging a hammer, and you can't anymore. And you have to adapt. And evolution favors that which is the most adaptable to change. But you have a lot of people here that don't like the idea that they have to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Obama said, "You can't work in a coal mine anymore. These are going out of business, but we'll train you. You can go to a trade school for free and you learn it." And then another guy goes, "No, I'm going to make it the 50s again."
Yeah.
And woohoo! Uh-huh. It didn't work, but that's what it's easy. It's
and
people
it's happened
like that.
Before. I mean, there, if
oh,
people
this is, it's seen, all happened
people would
before.
Still be riding carriages with horses.
Yeah, it's all happened before and it happens at different degrees. And then, you know, it's like, it's not your fault. It's Mexicans or communists or blacks or the Irish or witches or, you know, it's whatever they want to say. It's all happened before. And the other thing, culturally, you're at this point where white male privilege is losing traction. And, you know, people complain about this white male culture of grievance that I see a lot in comedy. A lot of male comedians are like, "Women are ruining everything." And you see what it is. It's like, yeah, white males have been ascendant in this country since its inception. Did you think they were going to go quietly? You know, they're going, you know, and I didn't say this, but it's true. When you're used to privilege, equality feels like oppression, you know, and that's all you're dealing with. And as someone said, it wasn't me, and I wish it was, that Donald Trump is the fireworks display at the conclusion of white male privilege.
know, it's like, yeah, it's just, there you go. It would be fitting if he was followed by the first women president. That would be a great thing. But
yes.
Yeah, we don't know. But I want to get more into the book Hit So Hard, which is you'd never written a book before.
No,
and it's so readable.
I had help. You know, but
did you
I approached it as
did you sit down and write it, or did you talk it?
I talked it, and you know, we'd have phone calls.
Right.
Me and Aaron, who helped me write it.
Sure.
But then I'd also go into you know, we worked on a Google Doc, and so I would just kind of be punk rock about it and just start writing about a moment. And then she'd go in and go kind of move things around. And,
Yeah. One of the most interesting books written by a musician, I thought, did you read Chronicle, the Dylan book?
No.
Because it just takes three very specific eras of his life.
Uh-huh.
It's like early 60s, 1969-70, and like 1983 or something. And that's all it talks about.
Why those specific?
It's, you know, like when he first kind of formed who he was, when he withdrew, and when he figured out how to keep going.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating in that regards, but it's like, I'm a Blood on the Tracks Desire era fan, and there's nothing in there. It's not in the focus.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that very interesting. But people are going to want to know. So you're in Washington. You're in that scene. It's the 80s, late 80s.
Yeah.
And you're drumming in bands. You're a functioning drug user and functioning alcoholic.
Yeah, for a bit. Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as soon as I started to get busier in the band, it was more of a trying to coordinate, you know, when I could get high and when I, you know, to show up. And then it's that sort of spiraled down into, okay, I'm on the road. I'm in, you know, Iowa and I'm strung out. What am I going to do?
It's so funny you say that, because Charlotte Caffey's stories in More Fun in the New World are the same story, but the music is the Go-Go's.
Yes.
Like, people had no idea. I mean, they were basically Josie and the Pussycats.
Yeah, and
by the time they broke, they were
Charlotte
a punk band.
And I are great friends.
Yeah.
And her stories are similar in, and it's amazing being such a big fan of the Go-Go's to hear Charlotte talk about, well, look at the talk show video. You can see there's a little bit of cocaine just around, you know, and like getting all the backstory is amazing.
Yeah. But it is amazing because people just saw the Go-Go's like, we got the One, they were a punk band. Yeah. They had a lot more than the beat.
Behind the scenes.
They had a Jones.
Yeah.
Fueling your addiction fills your day.
Yes. And a lot of the people in my peer group that came up and became successful didn't make it. And why did I make it? I was doing the same things they were, you know? And so coming through it, I felt like, you know, I was asked if I wanted to write a book. So I did. And a lot of people say, you know, how did you do it? How did you, you know, make it through? And it's like, there isn't one special, I couldn't say, well, it was this, because it's really a lot of different things, and it's not one giant burning bush moment or something.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Well, especially, and this is another thing you talk about in the book, sobriety and getting clean is elusive, especially if to get it to stick.
There's like 27 rehabs. Yeah, 27 in there, rehabs. I think. I don't know.
27.
You know, just
what was the shortest period between getting out of rehab and using again?
Oh, hours.
Yeah. No, people don't know.
I was on a plane from Hazelden. I landed. I took the car to the, you know.
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
First thing Richard Pryor did when he got home from the hospital after setting himself on fire was go up in his bedroom at Freebase.
Yes. I know it. I know that. Yeah.
And it is that story, you know, when I'm alone, I'm in bad company. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, my girlfriend at the time ODs, and, you know, ambulance comes, takes her, she's okay. But the first thing I did was like, that is some good dope. I'm going to, you know, and then just take advantage of it right there. You know, that's,
yeah. You meet Kurt Cobain.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-Nirvana?
Oh, no, during Nirvana.
Nirvana.
They'd just gotten together.
Yeah, they hadn't recorded Bleach yet.
No.
Right. And the scene is just starting to gel. It's just because you don't even know it's a scene. It's just you and your friends.
Yeah. Everybody's playing shows at, I was in a hardcore band. Well, we did some Stooges songs. Anyway, called The Primitives, and we played at this place called Community World Theater, which was an old movie theater in Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
And Nirvana played one of their first shows there, and they had think they did just Creedence songs. Wow. Yeah. They had some guy with a mustache who was their drummer. Remember? And yeah, and then they just, it was pre-Bleach, but there were some songs, and then they went and did recorded some songs on a local college station, and that's where I kind of heard the more polished collection of, you know, stuff that would eventually end up on Bleach.
So the scene is starting to gel, it's starting to form, and it's very far away from what's popular in mainstream music at the time.
And no one's thinking
you're in a bubble.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just to you, it's just, I'm doing this today.
And I became a good friends with Bruce Pavitt, who was the founder of Sub Pop Records.
Right.
And I would, you know, hang out with him, go over to his place, and he'd talk about what he gave me a ton of records. He was like, here's Surfer Rosa. He gave me that. Uh-huh. Explained this band's amazing. And this guy recorded is Steve Albini.
Right, explained that.
And then gave me, you know, a Pussy Galore, introduced me to a lot of great music, and then shared his ideas. Well, this is Mudhoney. They're going to be my first band I sign on my label, and sort of his idea for his label. And then, you know, it became a huge deal.
Yeah. Yeah. It became ginormous.
Yeah. There's those people along the way that introduced me to some amazing stuff. There's like Bruce, and I remember listening to that Dinosaur Jr. record. You're Living All Over Me, that record. And just, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to make music like that.
Now you're like, you have a purpose and you have a forward momentum in your life, but you also have this baggage of, and I don't know of a musician that I love that didn't struggle with it. I don't know of a clean, sober rock star during their ascendance. A lot of them clean up later, but even like somebody that I love and I've seen a billion times, who never had a famous crash, but like Elvis Costello, you still like, oh, I was drunk for years, I wrote that high on this. I mean, everybody's using, and I guess it's just an element of being a musician. I mean, it's just,
I
like,
mean, I think about,
was like, anybody, did you know anybody that didn't do anything?
The Red Hot Chili Peppers were, they were all strung up, then they got clean. But I remember being on a...
Clean is different from just being
straight. But I remember being on a trip to Brazil with Nirvana, and just, I went along just to go watch them play at this festival, and Red Hot Chili Peppers were playing, and Nirvana, and Alice in Chains, and L7. And I remember everybody being so wrecked, except for the Chili Peppers, which they would wake up every day and go on hikes on the mountain. And,
right.
And I was like, ooh, that kind of looks nice, you know, to do that.
Yeah.
But still, I don't know. I can't. I guess
Charlotte
that
Caffey tells that really funny story about making Rod Stewart stay up all night. And he's like, what? I have a show tonight. I can't stay up all night.
Yeah. It's just
do more drugs, you'll be fine. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, I don't think I really, what was the point of hanging out with someone who didn't do what I was doing?
Well, I remember reading 100 years ago a story about Bob Mould comparing Husker Du to the Replacements. Mm-hmm. And how, like, the Replacements were just the world famous fuck-ups.
Right.
And like Bob Mould was like, had the tour schedule, never bounced a check.
Right.
And no one, I'm like, yeah, that'd be me.
Yes. Yeah, there are the...
My girlfriend says, whenever she catches me cleaning, Virgo's got a Virg, man.
That's right. Virgo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Virg's got a Virg, man.
Yeah, there are those folks I know, but they always become tour managers, I think.
Yeah, do you know Danny Bland?
Yeah.
Yeah, Danny's a really good friend of mine, and it's just like, that's who I'd
be. Super suckers.
Like. Yeah. Yeah, and now he works with Dave Alvin, and he tells a great story that, like, you know, when he was touring with the Blasters in the old days, like after the show, he would literally write down the name of the hotel on their forearm because at least the cab driver could get him back.
Nice.
And now it's like, did you take your heart medication? Did you take your blood pressure medication? But this is the part of the book that really struck me, was that your bottom, which you write about very honestly. In turn, it hits so hard, it hits the reader so hard that you're so objective and about your bottom happens. It's not like the band breaks up and you find yourself with nothing to do. You're recording your second album and you're on top of the world. And you lived with Kurt and Courtney at the height of their fame and at the height of their tabloid fame, and being in the center of that storm, Kurt takes his life. And then a month later,
Kristen
takes her life.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the final straw.
No. I mean, as Kristen OD'd, and then she and I were, I had just done my first 30 days in mm-hmm. rehab, the beginning of many. Mm-hmm. And she overdosed and died. And that was a moment where we all kind of took a minute. And then, you know, we just recorded this record and we were going to tour for it. And it was it wasn't a major wake up call. It was a minute for me to go, whoa, you know, and then I gave it kind of in earnest to try to get clean and sober, you know, and I managed to stay clean after that for maybe 6 months out mm-hmm. on the road. And we started touring for Live Through This. And that right. was a grind. You know, it was amazing to go to see the world.
The most ironically named
yes
album in history.
Yes. But going through doing that and then experiencing kind of just where everybody was at, like culturally everybody was talking about what had happened with Kurt, and then also us dealing with it internally and things people would say.
And dealing with Courtney, who's not only her husband and the father of her child
yeah.
is gone, and people are accusing her of killing him.
Yeah.
I can't imagine living through that cauldron.
Yeah. And just taking that and then just kind of letting it sit inside me every day, you right. know, when and then
she
just
didn't
carrying
kill him,
it.
Right. No, I'm kidding.
And carrying it around. And then it just, then when you get home from tour, it's quiet. You know, here I am with myself.
Right.
You know, I couldn't, there was no way that I could deal with just that quiet and those, that thoughts. And I mean, as a person who hadn't really worked any kind of program at all. So
right.
the relief came, got home in my apartment, called the dealer. Mm-hmm. Then, oh, okay, I feel good. And then comes that rat, you know, that hamster on the wheel thing where I'm strung out. We have to go back out on tour. It's the worst way to live, you know, to like be stuck in some pro-dunk town in Wisconsin and
yeah.
try to figure out where am I going to go to score.
Right. And you can't get arrested because you'll screw up the tour.
Yeah. Yes.
A lot of people counting on you being there.
Yeah. And, you know, if I got arrested, it's not like they would just cancel the tour. It would just, they would call up Joe Schmo and he
right.
would come and take my place,
yeah.
you know.
They would call up the guy that filled in for Keith Moon when he passed out of the Boston Garden.
Yes. That guy.
It just yeah. flies around the country.
Him. Yes.
Talk about the Michael...
Beinhorn?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was our... After our...
It's such a...
It's a
punk rock Ringo moment.
It's such a cliche thing, though. It's like almost like I was so naive to
well,
that.
Well, let's just to put a celebrity... Live Through This. Live
yep.
Through This is a huge hit.
Right.
A huge hit in mm-hmm. Europe. And you drummed all over that album.
Yep. All over it.
Yeah. And then you're a successful band.
Yeah.
Two asteroids pound your band.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt.
Kristen.
Yep. Boom, boom. You survive.
Yeah. Pick up the pieces. Move on.
Yeah.
Finish the tour. Limping along at the end.
Right.
Basically.
And then you are getting, you're going to go back in the studio. That doesn't send you to the bottom. Of all the things.
Mm-hmm.
A record producer
yeah.
comes in, and I'm going to just tell you a part of that.
Yeah.
He's just not happy with your playing.
No.
And you find out later he's not even listening to your playing.
Right. We changed management. We got the rock, you know, machine management, the guys that manage Metallica. And,
yeah.
you know, that was like, and so their thoughts, and Courtney was all on board with it too, you know, like we're going to make this next step into arena rock.
Right.
So we're moving out.
Because that's where all the best music is played.
True.
Baseball stadiums.
In arenas. Yeah. So then, you know, we start writing songs and we get songs together and Billy Corgan comes in and, you know, twinkles the ivories a bit.
Yeah.
And so then we go into the studio. We get this guy who came recommended from rock and roll, basically. This
yeah.
guy had no cred as far as,
yeah.
like, the
He's
scene
like,
I come from.
The way you describe him, and then I looked him up on Google, and I look, and it is one of those things where you go like, yeah,
okay.
boy, if I was casting this guy, that's who I'd cast. but he sounds yeah. like the Bill Murray character on SNL with the satin jacket.
Yes.
When
yeah,
Gilda Radner would do Patti Smith.
The nightclub.
Yeah. How about a little Tusky? Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he shows up and he's doing his thing and he's like, we get into the studio and we start recording and he's like, do it again. And it was sort of like that thing where I describe it in the doc where I'm like in a pitching slump. He starts to like pound me, mm-hmm. you know, like through the yeah. through the glass, you know.
And
like,
you're alone. Not the good. Other band's the yeah. band's not there.
No. Do it again. Do it again. And then so pretty soon, and I wasn't going to give up. And and apparently that's his MO. He shows up. He did it to the guy in Soul Asylum. He did it to the guy in Korn, or he does it to these, you know, drummers. And then he gets his guy. You know, I call him Johnny One Take.
Right.
And he shows up special gloves and shoes and
right.
a little rat-a-tat.
Right.
And comes in and just does all the parts, gives him his money, he's out.
Right.
So
does everything.
Know, Johnny One Take's waiting in the
And
hotel
I'm
room.
Sure that if I listened to your take and Johnny One Take,
yes.
I would not know the difference.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, like.
But what's also but galling now, is that, but also, so that goes on. And your friend, Courtney.
Yeah.
Goes along with it.
Yeah.
Like they don't, she doesn't.
That was the betrayal was my yeah. band going, I don't know what to do. I don't know.
Yeah.
And Courtney looking at me going, Pat, this is business. It's just business, you know? And I took it so hard because
I would too. I would have walked.
And later on learning, you know, there's there's this program called Musicians Assistance Program and it's called MAP and it helps musicians go into rehab and I met some guys in the MAP program at the meetings that were like, that happens a lot, you know, like a lot of metal guys were replaced and
yeah.
I and still it sucks, but I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it's also, it's like, well, the Wrecking Crew, you know, their
right.
entire bands.
Yeah. I mean, it would be cool if Al Blaine showed up. I
yeah.
would not mind
yeah.
at all. You know, if he,
yeah, but
up.
It's just this guy's friend.
Yeah. So he,
well, it's like know, on the, in Pleased to Meet Me, the producer brought in Paul Westerberg just could not play, or it was Slim Dunlap by
yeah.
that point. Couldn't play this fill, but there's a great guy that can play it. Who is it? My son.
Oh my God. Was it a guitar part? Or
yeah.
A, yeah.
Yeah. I think it was on I Owe You Nothing. It's that
wow.
big, like burning. And it, I think it's, I could be wrong, but if I remember the article, it was the
was
producer.
It Matt Wallace? He did the
Well, they had a weird producer on that album.
Yeah.
It was like a Nashville guy. I don't want to say too much because I'm misremembering everything,
okay.
but I do remember that it was like, huh?
Uh-huh. You know, I can't just say and point the finger at and say he did it all because I definitely had a part in that situation. Showing up just out of rehab. Hello.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Not, I hadn't been playing drums in a while. So that there's my part in that situation was just, there was so much more work I could have done to prepare for that.
Mm-hmm.
But also I felt, you know, really robbed at that, my opportunity.
Yeah. No,
and
I know.
Those were my drum parts, you know.
Well, and, you're an artist.
Yeah.
You know.
And,
yeah. And you wrote those parts.
Yeah. So coming out of it, the goal was, this guy's just going to play your parts. No one's going to tell anybody. We're just going to keep on moving. And I was so angry. I said, fuck you guys.
I would
and
too.
And I checked out and, you
yeah.
know, went to Heroin Island.
Right.
You know, stayed there.
Right.
And, so they got another drummer and, you know, that's how
right.
it went down. And that was kind of the worst fear came true, you know, like all along when I was trying to negotiate
yeah.
my drug addiction and stuff was like, well, all I need to do is just keep my job and I'll be okay.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. And it's also the
happens.
Feel of it. And the gnawing feel like I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough.
Right.
I'm not good
and
enough.
It's true. You're not.
Well, it's just every addict's interior.
Yeah.
But that's
then,
every addict's internal monologue.
Right. And then so I go to the other side of it and just start rehearsing, like playing by myself and like becoming whiplashing myself, you know, like
right.
that movie. And trying to be so good that, and there was really no, I couldn't, I still have issues about going in the studio, you know, because of that whole time and
mm-hmm.
try to work on it. If things aren't feeling good, then fuck it. I don't have to, I'm not going to do this.
And that happens to everybody. I mean, like I'm pretty well respected as a comedian.
Yeah.
And I've always worked here at the Improv. And, a lot of my friends work at the Comedy Store and I would never go to the Comedy Store. So They said, you should call the guy that books a comedy store. And about a year ago, I called up and I said, hey, I'd like to come by and do some sets. And they said, hey, could you call back in a couple of months? We just passed a bunch of people from Flappers, which is in the comedy world.
In Burbank?
But the musical analogy would be like, we'd love to have you come and play, but we've just got some kids out of a junior high band. And we're going to let them try first. And they said, would you call back in a couple of months? And I just said, no. I don't need to do that. And it's nothing. It doesn't mean anything.
Right.
But it never ends. That feeling of like, I'm butthurt about it. Uh-huh. I'm still bitching about it 2 years later.
Yeah.
I haven't called back. I was like, fuck those guys. Mm-hmm. I don't need it. I don't, you know, I'm happy to go to the improv.
Yeah.
But it was, or were any other place. Yeah. But it's just like
a moment over. Don't you know who I am?
Yeah, you don't want to say that. And it's also, I'm sure if I spoke to the person that I spoke to, they wouldn't even remember it. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to fill out a schedule. But unfortunately, they articulated the voice in my head that's like, yeah, you're not good. It doesn't matter that you've been doing this 30 years. This guy's been doing it 6 months and he's just as good as you.
Like, damn.
Yeah, fuck you. Mm-hmm. I don't think so, Bill.
Yeah.
In entertainment, shit, it never ends.
Well, the thing about like, I don't want to be the drummer of Hole. I want to be, I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And I also do storytelling and I do a little bit of comedy here and there.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be like, I call it like Gary Coleman situation where everybody knows him from the kid from Different Strokes.
Right.
And like, I don't want to be.
But he's also a neuroscientist.
So I don't want to be like just that one hit.
No one knows Gary Coleman, neuroscientist.
The security guard.
Gary Coleman, neurosurgeon.
I'm a writer. I'm not. Yeah,
sure.
You know?
Yeah. Like when you were drumming, like who did you compare yourself to? Like who was your drumming hero?
Well, I love John Bonham.
Of course.
You know, also my peers like Danny Peters and Bud Honey or Dave Grohl.
Right.
And any of those guys were.
Right. And it's hard to be like, oh, I'm just me. And you have to accept that, like, well, we're not going to get to arenas.
Yeah.
But that's...
I'm not going to start my own band called the Foo Fighters.
Right, yeah.
And tour around.
Yeah, and it's just like, I'm going to do what I do. And John Doe is one of my heroes.
Yeah.
And I got to get to know him recently, which is surreal. And I've always equated my career to... his career.
Mm-hmm.
He would probably be offended to hear that. But it's like, yeah, I never became a ginormo star.
Yeah.
But everybody who matters respects what I do. And a lot of the people that are bigger than me were inspired by me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know that's true of him. I mean, I had a name droppy, but it's like I had a long conversation with Eddie Vedder mm-hmm. about how amazing X is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just
those moments
just,
when people come up and say,
you inspired me.
Yeah. And their career is pretty amazing so that's amazing to hear that.
And you must still get that.
I mean, I do.
Yeah.
And you know, I still play out and it's really nice to hear that. It's also nice to hear I read your book and I'm, you know, clean and sober and it inspired me that I can do it. About X, that I'm a huge fan of X also, and I work in a nonprofit called Rock and Roll Camp for Girls. And one summer, X-Zine came and volunteered. And, you know, after like the third day of we kind of knew each other, just sort of acquaintances. About the third day, she was there, we were having lunch, and I sat next door and we talked a bit, and I said, I just love your work, you know. And she said, oh, I love, you know, I like that thing you did with so-and-so, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And X had some shows coming up. And she said, she talked about her band so respectfully. And so when I talked about how important they were to me, she expressed such a kindness and respect for her bandmates after that amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So... still loving their process and how they write and them as musicians and people. It was so amazing. So much integrity. Such an amazing woman.
Absolutely. And all of them, you know, John, they talk about, I think by now, you know, they see the band as, you know, that's a boat that will always keep them above the waterline. And they still create that. They have new songs.
And it's so good to hear that because that's not the case mostly.
It's not. You know? And that they're still... creating. And that's, it doesn't matter if you are playing the Enormo Dome or if you're at the Whiskey, if you're doing what you want to do, people hate their jobs.
Yeah.
And people spend so much of their waking lives doing something that they're bored at or hate, that you actually get to, and this is something that you get with sobriety. It's like, oh, it's a gorgeous day.
Yeah. To be grateful about it.
Yeah. And I almost got killed 2 months ago. Like, yeah. I'm really fucking happy that I'm here right now.
Yeah. Sort of gives you a little tweak.
It gives you a big, gives me a big tweak. Yeah. I was seconds away from sitting in the wrong seat.
When the Pixies got back together and they started touring
again, had to raid the Magic Castle to reassemble their band.
I was playing drums for Juliet Lewis, and we were playing like some side tent, and they were playing the main stage at the Voodoo Festival.
Uh-huh.
And I remember going to watch them and them opening, you know, and starting to play, and like they played like maybe Bone Machine or something.
Right.
And that feeling that I had when I first heard them, it still comes
still
back.
There? Yeah.
It's still, that gets conjured up when I hear those songs.
Yeah.
It's so amazing. And only a few, you know, people have that ability to create that.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's, you only get to be new once.
Uh-huh.
And you only get, with very few exceptions, you know, you have an explosion and then you've got another 60 years that you've got to navigate.
Uh-huh.
And to be able to do that and still, and to be alive and to do what you love doing. For me, having children is the most freeing thing because it stops being about you.
Mm-hmm.
So many people I know, it's like, my career, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, it will make you see your career clearly.
Yeah.
Make you see what it is clearly.
Yeah. My daughter could really, she does not care when I, you know, when I'm performing or whatever I'm doing. And I played at her school. You know, there was some event where parents had to get together and play. And there's her school, there were some pretty amazing players as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
And, you know, the kids were like, oh my God, I saw your mom play it, you know, and she's
sure.
like, meh. I get concerned about not pushing her in certain directions. Mm-hmm. Like, you know,
what does she want to do?
Play the drums. She wants to, well, she likes dancing. That's, you know, kind of her thing, but it's always changing. So,
you say that,
you know,
so, when is it going to so be? So pained.
Yeah. When's it going to, you know, like what?
You know, my middle daughter is a cheerleader and I feel like I failed as a parent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I made a cheerleader. My oldest daughter is, you know, I'm in this show, Creep Show, that's coming out on Shudder.
Uh-huh.
It's Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the premiere is this Monday at the Egyptian Theater. And my oldest daughter is 17. She likes horror movies and stuff like that. And I was like, hey, do you want to go to the premiere with me? And she's like, I have tennis.
Yeah. God. It's like, yeah.
It's like, yeah, you can walk the red carpet. Yeah. No, I have tennis.
Oh my God. When you did,
it's so great.
When you did the Zaya stuff for the that was like
such
a moment, and for me, and I didn't get to go, but I saw it on YouTube. And where was it at the Egyptian? What were you dressed up like Zaya?
Yeah, I did. I've done a bunch.
I've done
it a lot.
The guy, okay, there's
the strangest.
Two guys at my kids at B school. Two other dads that are into apes. So us three, we have our own ape club, we called it, privately. We don't tell a lot of the other. There was a fourth guy who wanted to get in, but we didn't.
Not good enough?
Yeah. And we all went to, was it UCLA or USC that had the...
Yeah, USC.
Yeah, we went there and we looked at all the stuff.
Yeah, that was an amazing show. That
I
was an
seen
amazing show.
Any of the newer...
Oh, they're great.
The new ones?
Really? They're great.
Well,
yeah,
like,
they're great.
Like,
I really enjoy them.
Like
the Tim Burton one is atrocious.
Dr. Zaya said there was basically no films after Battle. Was that what?
Yeah, yeah. I have never heard of any of them after Battle.
And he lives in where?
He lives up in Ohio.
Yeah. That's so perfect.
I live out near Susie Flechette.
And the other ape in the Yip Club. Robert Napton works at Legend Comics. He
That's so funny.
He went to the, it was a retirement home for actors. That's where the Caesar statue is.
The Caesar statue used to be in my old backyard because I used to live in Roddy McDowell's old house, which was not intentional.
Oh my God.
My wife and I were looking to buy a house. And we were planning on having a family. And so we're looking around, and I wanted to live either in the Valley or in Larchmont, Hancock Park.
Okay.
I didn't want to live West Side. I don't like the West Side. I'm not a West Side dude.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at this house in the Valley. It's too big for us, but we know we're going to have kids. And it was at the high end of our price range. But we're looking at it, and the realtor goes, yeah, I guess an actor used to live here, this guy, Roddy McDowell. And I could see my wife like looking at me, like, and because it's not only my favorite movie, it's her father's favorite movie. So that was a done deal at that instant.
Right.
The statue was not there at the time. It had already been moved out and refurbished by my friends and put in the Screen Actors Guild Retirement Home, which is where your friend saw it.
Yeah.
And it's Roddy's Rose Garden.
Yeah, Roddy's Rose Garden.
The Caesar statue from Battle. But I got the same guy, made a copy of the Lawgiver bust from the original, and I put it in the backyard there, so I kind of reestablished it.
The Lawgiver, it's just, there's no scroll or anything. It's not like
bleeding. It's just the bust.
Yes.
Okay. And the Lawgiver statue is my friend Brian owns the Lawgiver statue. It's at his house. It's 9 feet tall. It's a big one. It's a big one. Yeah. No, the people that are in it are in it heavy, but I don't know what it is about that thing. It was like Star Wars for another group of people. It just like, it just rings your bell for some reason.
There's
I don't know why.
Theory that my brother and I have called background apes. And what it is when you watch, maybe not so much in the first, but maybe the second, definitely in Conquest.
The Bad Masks?
And Escape is in the background. You can see
The beneath is full of bad.
We call them
bad
the background apes.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, there's definitely a lot of background apes in this. Like
I have
the kind of half-assed budget.
I have one of the chimp ones in my other room. Because I lived, before I moved into Roddy's house, I lived next door to Dan Strepek, who ran the 20th Century Fox makeup department.
Oh, okay.
And I met him at a neighborhood parking meeting. And I just recognized him from reading Famous Monsters magazine as a kid.
Right.
And I went, are you Dan Strepek? And he went, yeah. And I would just recited his career to him. And he just came by my house a couple of days later and gave me an extras mask. It was the craziest thing. I almost started crying.
Wow.
I didn't know what
and
to say.
And they look kind of funny, too.
They look, it's like, why don't you make them look as good as the makeup?
They're all gorillas, mostly.
Yeah, well, they're all, no, the chimp ones are bad, too.
And
they're
then,
all
have
bad.
Have you seen the,
yes,
a
I
lot
have.
Of those whatever. Black and white? Black and white photos of the making of, and there's all those bodybuilders.
Oh yeah.
The little kid apes.
Yep.
And sitting on lap, or maybe
I have a photo of. We're gonna get back to track. This year old. Now we're down.
Well,
the rabbit.
To talk apes.
Oh
no,
I didn't know that. Now we're down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, we're here.
I have a picture of Felix Silla, who is a Hollywood little person, who played Tweaky the robot in the Buck Rogers TV series.
Okay.
He played the child gorilla that walks up to Charlton Heston at the. In the funeral and goes, look, it's a man.
Yes.
Okay. I have a photo of his makeup artist, Don Cash, holding him up at a urinal because he couldn't reach the urinal. And so he's holding him up and he didn't sign it to me, but somebody took a screen. It was like, when you got to go, you got to go. And it is amazing that all of this stuff still exists. And that's Eddie Murphy is a big Planet of the Apes guy.
Really?
Yeah, he is. And he had a really great observation about it, which I didn't know. It's the Wizard of Oz.
Really?
Like you go through this whole adventure and then it's like, oh, so I was in Kansas the whole time.
And you pull out the rug.
Yeah, I was in Kansas the whole time.
Yeah. But that ending is so like used in so many.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. And Simpsons.
Simpsons did it and Spaceballs did it. And there was a lot of people claim to have come up with that ending. Blake Edwards was originally attached to the film to direct it. He said he came up with it. A lot of people came up with it. And I saw one of the producers, a guy named Mort Abrahams, he spoke at a thing.
Yeah.
And somebody asked him, who came up with the ending? And he goes, Rod Serling came up with that ending. Statue of Liberty half buried in the sand is what you get when you write Rod Serling a check. Which I loved because it was so like meat and potatoes. Like, it's like ask the line producer. He knows.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ask the guy who knows where the trucks are.
Shimmy.
you're married now?
Yeah, married. And then I...
To a dude?
No, no. I got married to a woman in 20...
Wait a minute. Wait, what?
2005, we got together. We got married in 2008. We had our daughter in 2010. And just last year, we were divorced.
Okay. So, that happens.
Yeah. And we're...
Said the divorced guy.
Yeah. And I saw one of your stand-ups about bits about divorce. And I was like, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That's the way that a lot of... When I talk about my addiction, I talk about the hard stuff, but... I also make jokes about it too.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah.
And having that sort of connection with relating to your bits about divorce helps me sort it out too, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's how do you get through it if you don't want to, you know, you can't find the funny parts.
Somebody told a great joke. It's an old street joke. A comedian named Alex Edelman told me this joke last night. And it's a street joke, but it's a great joke about like you have to joke about everything. And the guy dies. And he goes to heaven, and he meets God, and he doesn't know what to say to God. So he decides, I'm going to tell God a joke. I'll tell God a joke. And he tells God a Holocaust joke. And God goes, I don't think that's funny. Mm-hmm. And God goes, guess you had to be there. Yeah. Oh, you had to be there. But now you're co-parenting.
Yeah.
You're still making music. You're writing.
Yeah, I do. I play in bands still and, you know, do recording with friends when they ask me to, you know, and then right now I'm doing a lot of storytelling of like The Moth and Risk. I'd like to do a thing with Risk and I've done a lot of UCB ASCAT monologues.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Just so much fun.
I can't see them doing sketches off of your mouth.
There's so much, like so many stories. There's stories I don't have in the book that I tell to that audience that, uh-huh. that are a little more.
Sure. Yeah. Hardcore.
Yeah.
But those guys are, I mean, those ASCAT, they're amazing.
Yeah. Matt Besser.
Yeah. Like they don't leave any meat on the bone.
I know. And
they
Betsy
use
Sodaro.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's alarming. Scott, have you ever seen Scott Adsit improvise?
Yes. Yeah.
It's not like comedians improvising. It's like, no, this is what this is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Janet Varney, too.
I never it's like really knew
terrifying
what it was all about until I witnessed what they do.
Yeah.
I like just showing up without carrying a drum kit.
Yeah. But also, like, you won.
Yeah. I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to believe. Yeah. You're still here.
What I have and what do I have to offer is, you know, I got some stories.
Yeah. Well, you lived. I mean, you and I both know a lot of people that should be here that aren't.
Right.
And, I won.
Yeah.
Zabrecki, same thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
His book's great.
Yeah. But it's like, yeah, you're here. You won. You're doing shit. And that's the people that agonize over their level of success or whatever. Just like, it's like you talk about glasses in the book that.
Yeah.
Lenses make you feel, you know, sometimes it's great when you put on glasses because you just these things clearly.
Yeah.
You like alcohol because it made you see them less clearly.
Right.
Yeah. Which is a great observation. Yeah. But when you have that realization, if you're lucky enough to have it, that your life is about your life. Stephen King said, your life is not a support system for your art. Your art is a support system for your life.
Uh-huh.
It's like getting the correct prescription. It's like, oh.
Yeah. And then this it gets it. Tuned in and then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the book is called Hit So Hard and the documentary is also called
Hit So Hard.
Hit So Hard. Yeah. They're really required viewing. It's really amazing. Thank Are you still friends with
the band?
With the band?
Yeah. She and I text a lot. And mm-hmm.
Melissa, is she up here down there?
She's here actually.
Uh-huh.
And Eric's in town too. And Melissa's out in New York and I see her the most probably because we both have daughters the same age and mm-hmm. we get together. And yeah, there's a little bit of talk about getting the band back together.
Sure.
So I don't know that we'll see it when it happens, if that ever does. I don't know.
Well, I play the clarinet.
That's
just
right.
Keep that in mind. Patty Shell, thanks so much
Thank
for coming
you.
By.
On the podcast, reach for the sky, Dana Goldbaum.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by The Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board.
produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano.
Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a person. I'm a singer. I love to sing and DJ. Boom. Peace out. You want me? Peace out. Boom.